Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, we have a returning guest and a crowd favorite in Jason Rothman, the After Dinner Investor. Now, it's been about 9 months roughly since Jason was on the podcast, and unfortunately, we were a little short on time for this episode just with how our schedules worked out. So, slightly shorter episode than I usually try to do, but there was a lot of info that we kind of covered in this episode. We talked through how 2022 has been for Jason so far, some of the interesting things that he's kind of been thinking about and implementing with tax loss harvesting. And then we also spent a good bit of time on Jason's thoughts on oil. We're seeing Warren Buffett load the truck really through Berkshire Hathaway on a couple of different oil stocks. And Jason has a pretty successful track record investing in oil in the stock market. So we spent a good bit of time on that and also a good amount of time on Google. Jason actually works in that space and has kind of a business that revolves around Google Ads and has some expertise in that industry. And he's added Google in size to his portfolio this year. So had a good chance to cover that as well as a kind of a couple of audience questions towards the end of the episode too. So I think you'll really enjoy this one. If you want to follow along with more of what Jason's doing, his links will be down in the description as well for his podcast, the After Dinner Investor podcast. But for now, let's roll the episode and I hope you enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a returning guest. Some of you may know him as the intense, ferocious cloner. Some of you may know him as Jackson from Punchcard Investing. I know him as Jason Rothman, the After Dinner Investor. How are you, sir?
Tom, I'm doing excellent. Thank you for having me on. It was quite a surprise and quite enjoyable when you asked me to come on. I'm thrilled to be on and get to talk to you. I don't get to go on Punch Card that much these days, as I was telling you before we started recording. Everyone seems to be showing up. I think last time I was on, I did a really, really good job. And I think not you, but some of the other hosts are feeling a little threatened. And they buttoned it up and they started showing up again. So whenever they're not there, I'm down. But if not, you'll see me in the chat. So
doing great. I think you're right. You're a crowd favorite at this point, Jason. The people love you. There's just something about that voice I think is soothing. I don't know quite what it is.
I don't know. I like to bring a certain energy to the show, certain enthusiasm when you're not on there every week. And then you're in the chat and you're shouting at the phone and they don't hear you and you do your super chats and they barely even recognize them, even when you do a lot of money. When you finally get that microphone turned on and you see the red light, it's go time. So
love it.
Love that show. Hey, by the way, really love what you guys are doing. And it seems like it's growing and it's a very unique thing. And I got to tell you, I think I speak on behalf of a lot of the audience. I really look forward to seeing you guys and chatting with everybody on Friday nights.
Yeah, appreciate that. It is good fun. We'll definitely have to get you on there again in future when, I don't know, people decide to sleep in or go away for the weekend or whatever they do. You're top of the reserve bench at the moment,
okay,
Jason.
Good. So I'm sure that's where I like to be. King of the losers. So
oh, come on. Okay. So I was just looking a couple of days ago. I think it's been 9 months since we had you on the podcast, and there's been a few things going on since then. I think last time around we were talking about Seritage and Alibaba, and you were just kind of getting familiar with Tencent at that time. So what's kind of been happening over the past 9 months, and how's this year been for you so far?
The year's been good, a lot better than 2021. So as we kind of get back to normal, I've really enjoyed that. As far as markets and investing go, it feels like a whirlwind. Like it's been a very, very quick year for me. And I don't think I've made a lot of new investments. I've kind of drilled down on the things that I'm invested in. I guess Google, I'm looking at something here. It says May 3rd is when I first started buying Google. So I guess Google's a big one. I think we're going to talk about that. I did some dancing with Tencent through Prosys and Alibaba. We can talk about that if you want, with some tax loss harvesting. I learned a big lesson there and got lucky. And just kind of, I feel like I've learned a lot about investing in the last 9 months. I was doing this thing called Tea Time Live with my after dinner investor. I went away from it because I was just doing too much of it, not in a balanced way. But now I'm back as of this week. And there's something about having to talk about investments and investing every single week that I think really helps you kind of stay in the mindset and stay learning. And I've come up with this theory that I'm basically, you're either getting better or getting worse every day. And even if you just get a little bit better, that's better than getting a little bit worse every day. And I noticed when I took some time off from investing, if you will, for the last month and a half or 2 months, I felt like I was getting worse. And so I'm back in the game now. And that was kind of my first half of 2022. And it's been just quite eventful in the markets. It's definitely a different market than where we last talked 9 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of overlap with me as well. I think this year has gone pretty fast. I don't know that I've made any investments in new companies besides my single Berkshire B share, but it's kind of you know, getting increasingly familiar with the stuff that I already own and trying to learn new industries and that sort of thing where I can. It's kind of flown by.
I guess 9 months ago was Q3 turning into Q4 2021. Peak of the craziness, peak of the bubble. And I don't know if rewarding was the right word, seeing a lot of that stuff crash, but it was a good reminder of like, yeah, things do get out of whack. And if your gut is telling you something seems off with some investments and prices, it's okay to feel different than the market. But it was such an intense bubble. It just, there were definitely times during that year where I questioned myself, like, you know, just different asset classes, if you will, or different kinds of companies. Maybe I'm getting something wrong, but it's nice to see that kind of happen. And just to be reminded that, yeah, things do come down if they don't make sense being up that high.
Yeah, I agree. I was actually watching back some of our previous episode and we were talking about how, you know, there was some of this interesting Chinese tech stuff that both of us were looking at the time. And are still kind of pretty interested in, I would say. But yeah. We were kind of just saying there doesn't seem to be a whole lot else out there. And I think that's changed pretty significantly. Although I don't think either of us have been hugely active. I feel like I've got a lot more on my radar that's it's getting pretty interesting.
Yeah, I feel like, I'll put it this way. There's a lot of things out there like Amazon, like PayPal, that looked like they were caught up in the mix, if you will, with a lot of those things that weren't wonderful businesses that went up a lot as those two companies did. But there's what I'm finding a lot outside of the stuff in my portfolio is that when I go around and look, I look at things that are down 40, 50, 60%, sometimes more. And then I look at the price versus what they're expected to earn in the coming years. And still stuff doesn't seem especially attractive to me. So I did a big bet on Google or Alphabet. I did a little dancing with Alibaba and Tencent via Prosus. Did a little dancing with Coupang. But other than that, it's pretty much just Alphabet. And I did a little merger workout with Activision Blizzard. And I think that's been it. And I still hold a lot of the stuff that I was holding last time we talked.
Yeah, nice. Well, let's. I know we're a little short on time today, so let's dive into it a little bit. Let's start with the Prosus Tencent dancing, as you put it. What's been happening there?
So I don't think you have to deal with this in New Zealand, but here we have the capital gains taxes, and basically, I had never heard of tax loss harvesting, and then I heard about it a little bit because Monish talked about going from Alibaba to Tencent via Prosus. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. But I still wasn't that attracted to doing it. And then I had a huge capital gains bill for 2021. And I was like, okay, I got to figure out this tax loss harvesting. That kind of coincided at the same time that Charlie sold Alibaba. And what I learned from that is, one, I just learned about tax loss harvesting in general, the 30-day windows on the front and backside and all that kind of stuff. And what I did is Prosus was down a lot, Alibaba was down a lot. It seemed like Alibaba was down a little bit more. Alibaba got to a ridiculous price where you could back out the cash, and I think you could argue that it was maybe 5 or 6 times earnings at some point, something like that, and just got down to a ridiculous price. And I kind of did the opposite of what Monish did. I went from Prosus and Tencent. I sold that. I parked the money half in Alibaba, half in Google, which is the other thing I wanted to buy at the time. But let's just stick to the Alibaba portion of it. I had watched those two businesses trade for about a year, and they really kind of traded in tandem. If there was going to be good news out of China, both of them were going to go up. If there was bad news out of China, both of them were going to go down. And what I did is I parked the money in Alibaba. I waited 30 days. Alibaba went up more than Prosus. Google was not up as much as Prosus. But overall, I think it kind of worked out because I was able to book that tax loss. But here's the thing I learned when I got back into Prosus. Shortly after I got back into Prosus, they did their announcement that they're going to be selling some Tencent shares to then buy back Prosus at a discount. Less Tencent is actually more Tencent because of the way it sells at a discount and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And the stock price is up 60% from the recent low. There's a very good chance I would have missed that, and I would have been sitting there holding Alibaba. And I just got purely lucky that I was able to get back into Prosus just a couple weeks before they announced that, and I was able to enjoy the gain and not have that go up when I was not holding it. And Alibaba it's not up as much as Prosus. So the key thing I learned here is that I think the smart way to do tax loss harvesting is to do an inverse tax loss harvest, what Charlie Munger did. Some people borrow money, some people sell other stuff, some people have money coming in, but you buy more of the thing that's down. And then basically 30 days later, you can sell what you owned previously in that holding, and you can pick out those shares and you can say, I don't want to sell the shares that I bought 31 days ago. I want to sell the shares that I bought at a much lower cost basis, much higher cost basis, and book that loss. So everyone, like people always say, needs to do their own research and look this stuff up themselves. But what I love about the inverse tax loss harvest and what people think Charlie Munger did with Alibaba, you buy first, you buy more first at that lower price. You lock in the purchase at that lower price. And then if the stock stays flat or goes down, then you can sell what you bought at much higher prices 31 days later and book that tax loss. Again, do your own research. But if the stock price zooms up on you, like Prosus very easily could have done for me, or on that time period, you don't miss that run-up. You get to participate in the run-up. And then if you want to sell and pay off your loan or whatever, you can. Or if you want to just hold it, you can hold it. So I'm currently doing that right now with Coupang. And Coupang's up a lot in this little 31-day time period. I have to wait. And so I'm glad I did it that way. But that was a tremendous lesson. I should have been smart enough to figure it out ahead of time. But just missing this run-up in Prosus, or just making it barely and getting lucky, it kind of seared in this lesson for me that, okay, in my opinion, tax loss harvesting does make sense. But you have to do it. For me, I'm going to do it in an inverse way. So that was a big lesson I learned. I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah, I like it. I've really never seen anyone do it that way until Charlie. I don't know why more people don't do it that way. And the interesting thing that Charlie did was he took on margin to do it. Is that something you're doing, or you could see yourself doing if you were already fully invested?
Yeah, I'm taking on margin as we speak. Right. There's a beautiful program out of Citibank. I have one of their credit cards. It's called a City Flex Loan. It's not like a traditional loan. They don't run your credit. It's just tied to the credit limit you have on your credit card. And let's say you had a $10,000 credit limit on your credit card and you haven't spent anything that month. You have a full $10,000. They will let you lock in an up to 5-year loan for up to $10,000, up to your credit limit. The interest rates I got were 7%. And then I did it again like 2 days later and they quoted me 10%. And I was a little annoyed by that. I was like, is that you guys just knowing I want this loan or flex loan, or is that interest rates? Now they look to be about 8 to 9%. I know people would say, well, you could go get 6 or 7% with margin. There's other places where you can get probably lower with margin. I have a little bit of emotional problem when a loan is tied to my securities. And I just have never been comfortable with that because stock prices can do anything, as Buffett says, anything at any time. And I just hate the idea of a brokerage being able to go in there and sell stuff without my choice. And I just am not comfortable with that. So I'm willing to pay a higher interest rate for a temporary time period. But yeah, I'm doing that right now. I'm doing it with Activision Blizzard, a merger workout, if you will. And that was inspired by the book, The Ground Rules. It's a great book about Buffett's partnership letters and his early days. And they talked about him taking margin on to buy merger workouts back then. And then, of course, he bought it recently, Activision Blizzard. So it's a clone. It's a clone of Buffett in the 50s doing it with margin. It's a clone of Buffett in the 2020s with the position of Activision Blizzard. And I'm doing a reverse tax loss harvest with Kuping right now. But I'm doing a very small percent. I think in the after dinner investor portfolio, I have like $3,500 of margin on like about $80,000 of assets. So keeping it very small, but it's been something I wanted to explore a little bit because I feel like if I do it responsibly with a very, very small amount and in situations like a inverse tax loss harvest or a merger workout, I feel comfortable with it when it's a very, very, very small percent of the overall portfolio. So yeah, I've been getting my feet wet a little bit with that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've been, we're sort of working through the process of buying a house at the moment, and I'm kind of figuring out the best way to structure the debt we're likely to have just to give us as much flexibility as possible. Different situation to what you're working with wash sale rules and capital gains tax and stuff. But I think I'm going to like the option to have some sort of line of credit type flexibility where you've got potentially reasonably priced kind of debt and it's not directly tied to stocks like a margin loan would be. So I like that. Changing tack slightly. So this is, you mentioned before, one of the reasons that you kind of got into this tax loss harvesting stuff is firstly seeing Charlie do what he was doing, but secondly you had a large capital gains tax bill, and I suspect a good chunk of that was explained by oil. We've been seeing some pretty big moves by the biggest investors in oil. We've seen Buffett just buy Oxy hand over fist. He's got a big chunk of the portfolio in Chevron as well. Oil prices have been all over the place and generally heading upwards pretty quickly the last few months. So do you still have holdings in oil? How are you thinking about that space at the moment?
Yeah, I still have a pretty sizable position in Ring Energy. Probably at the peak, it was like 40% of the after dinner investor portfolio. Other stuff has gone up. I've sold a lot of it. I think I'm down to owning like 20% of what I owned in Ring at one point, right, in terms of share count, but still like a 10% position. And then I own a little bit of a company called Pedevco. And that's what I have. What was the question, Tom?
It was basically just how you're thinking about oil at the moment. I mean, I know there's sort of a few ways to look at it. Like a lot of people are looking at just these massive free cash flow yields that oil companies are throwing off at the moment with high oil prices. I know you pay attention to net asset values and have some other views as well. So just wondering where you're at with that.
My investing style basically comes down, I've got two moves, basically that's it. One move is net asset value plays, kind of balance sheet plays. Like initially that's the way Prosus started. Okay, they own this many 10 cent shares. Prosus is selling for a lot less. I feel like I have a margin of safety. I'm buying more than I'm paying for value investing kind of 101. The other one is growing pies, wonderful businesses, free cash flow yields and all that kind of stuff. When it comes to oil, I've always been more of a net asset value, an asset value kind of play. That's originally why I got into Ring Energy. I don't think at this point I'm good enough to kind of make decisions on free cash flow yields and that sort of stuff with oil companies because the price of what they sell is so volatile. What I've basically, I guess also what's happened is I was tarnished, if you will, or spoiled with the Ring Energy investment. I've never seen anything like it where the net asset value is so much bigger than the price of the business. Maybe I've seen it a few times in oil where the company's guaranteed to go bankrupt because there's so much debt. But when a company actually has a good chance at survival, I've never seen anything like it where it sells for such a low price compared to the net asset value. The way I go about that is there's something in oil accounting called PV10, and there's also something called the standardized measure. And basically, these companies get third-party firms to look at their reserves. And Tom, you're not in oil. I talk about oil a lot, and you're still not in it, but I know you have an interest in it. What I want to convey to you is that it's very, very simple. I hope I get that across. It's like very easy. You don't have to do the work yourself. They do it for you. They look at what the reserves are. They look at what you will expect to make with those in revenue, and they do the whole timeline, like this is going to sell it this year, blah, blah, blah. Then they take the expected expenses and they take your expected profit of those from those reserves and they discount it back at 10%. That's the PV10. And the reason they have the PV10 is so oil and gas investors can kind of look at a standard way of comparing oil company to oil company. And then they have the standardized measure, which is essentially the same thing, but then they also backtrack out the expected taxes that they're going to pay. So it's a true expected profit if you agree with their estimates and if you agree with the 10% discount rate, all that kind of stuff. But they kind of put it there for you black and white on paper, like our reserves, the net present value of them after the expenses discounted back at 10% are this number. And then you can look at, okay, well, that's that number. That's the assets. Take away the debt. That's the net asset. Compare that to the price the company's selling for, shares outstanding, fully diluted times the price. And you can see what you're buying. And the thing with PV10, and I think it is the same thing with standardized measure. How do you know what those reserves are going to be worth? And with PV10, they go, again, I'm pretty sure about this, but could always be wrong, but they go with what the price of oil was and what the price of natural gas was on the first day of each month for the previous year. So they give you a PV10 for 2021, and that is based on the price of oil and gas, oil, and then separately the price of gas on the first day of each month during the 12 months of 2021. And they give you that average price. And then they tell you, this is our PV10 based on for 2021. It's probably in the $60 oil and three something gas. It's going to be a lot higher in 2022 when the 2022 PV10s come out on the annual reports in 2023, it's going to be a lot higher because the average price was higher. And so what I've done with like Ring Energy right now, I'm looking at buying it again. And basically what I do is I go, okay, what's the PV10 for 2021? Because that's what we have. They actually give us that in the annual report. Then I back out the taxes. What's the standardized measure? And what is the price of the company? And then I'm able to see what I'm buying for that price. And then here's the key thing that I focus on. You can't just say PV10 or standardized measure, the net present value of the assets. You can't say that in a vacuum because it depends on what the prices were that year. But that one year is a vacuum. And you got to get outside the vacuum and you got to go, are those realistic prices going forward? And so like Ring Energy's 2021 PV10 is based on like 60 something oil and 3 something gas. And by the way, they're at the time they were like 85% oil. So that's come down as they've done an acquisition. But the point is that's 60 something dollar oil. And just sticking to oil prices for a second, what I like doing is I like buying Ring for a price that's less than the net asset value that's based on 60 something dollar oil, not $90 oil or $105 oil, because then you can kind of work in a margin of safety, if you will. And I'm able to go, well, for example, like I think with the Ring Energy acquisition, I've done some rough numbers. I could be way off on this, but I don't want to give that high of a number and get people excited. So let's say $5. And I think it's higher than that, but let's say the net asset value of Ring Energy is $5. Take away their debt, away from their assets, it's $5. Buying the company at $2.50, you're buying $5 of assets for $2.50 per share. Now, what I like knowing is that that $5 number is based on 60 something oil. And anything above that, this $90, $100 oil, that's all gravy. And then you've got to ask yourself about the downside. And you've got to look at what's the break even for the company in terms of price of oil. What kind of expected money are they going to make if oil stays at your low price? I think for me, again, this is just kind of, I don't know, just I wouldn't say I'm not an expert in this field, but I don't think I'm a beginner either. But kind of the number for me is I don't really think an American oil and gas industry would exist if oil stayed below $45 a barrel for an extended time period. So what I ask myself is, what kind of position is Ring going to be in at $45 a barrel of oil? And then lately, since things are so high, I'm kind of upping that to maybe, you know, what would they be like at 60 something dollar oil? We see that with their 2021 PV10, and then I can make my decision. So for me, I've kept it simple. It's always been a net asset value kind of play. But a lot of people are in oil these days, I think, for the free cash flow and the dividends and buybacks and all that kind of stuff. So there's two ways to look at it. I've always been more comfortable with the net asset value play. That said, Tom, I've only ever seen companies sell for a massive discount to the net asset value two times, and that's PEDEVCO and Ring Energy. Everything else seems to sell for PV10 or double PV10. So maybe I won't get that opportunity again, and I'll have to go with the cash flow thing. But that's the way I've looked at it with those two investments.
And why do you think there is such big variation in the market price versus the PV10? Like, why would a company ever sell at a premium to that number?
Well, with why would they sell for a premium? Because I think in this case, like in a 2022 environment when oil is $90,
I see. Yeah,
yeah. If the most recent PV10 or standardized measure is based on 2021 $65 gotcha. Oil,
yep.
And as an investor, they think for the next 5 or 10 years, oil is going to stay well above that. Then it would sell for that. The other reason is because PV10 and standardized measure is not be all end all. I've seen oil and gas CEOs on earnings transcripts and calls make fun of PV10. And they said something, one of them said something like, look, I don't know about this, whatever you guys want to focus on, PV10, standardized measure, whatever. We don't do that. I'm a businessman. I focus on free cash flow, return on investment. And he was kind of down talking PV10 and standardized measure. Now, that company happened to have a very high price to PV10. Maybe it had something to do with that. But it's also not the be-all, end-all. And I would think probably the majority of people focus on cash flow, dividend. And maybe it's just one of those things. Maybe you're asking me like, well, why don't companies sell for a P? Why don't companies sell for, let's think about what PV10 is, discounted back at 10%. I don't do good with these discounted cash flows. I'm still trying to, it's just not up my alley as much as some people love them. But if that's PV10, maybe that means something with the number 10. Maybe that's asking, why don't companies like Apple or Google or even Target, you know, why don't they sell for a PE of 10? And maybe it's because people put a higher value than 10 times the earnings. And they do that with a lot of oil and gas companies as well. It's also the environment we're in. It's just maybe if we go through an oil and gas depression, they would sell for that. But I've only seen it with those two companies.
Yeah, gotcha. One more question on oil, then I'm keen to maybe talk Google for a little bit.
You're disgusted with the oil stuff. You want to get back to the growing pies.
Well, I've only ever invested, I think, in one commodity company, which is GrafTech. And one of the things that was interesting with GrafTech is they had, you know, the whole idea was they had these locked in contracts, and we thought we were going to get the market cap back in cash. And
I've retired from
you know the story. I won't tell
you. We've all retired from it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the things that's held me back from investing in other commodities, maybe I'm scarred from that experience. I don't know. But it's just that those commodity prices are kind of unknown is one part of it. And I guess, like you say, having that floor where you think, you know, at a certain oil price, American oil businesses just won't exist because that's presumably below their break even. Maybe that's one part of it. The other part that I see from, you know, people talking about oil companies on Twitter and that sort of thing is just that the capital allocation varies super widely across all these companies. Like some of these businesses will be making acquisitions, some of them will be paying dividends, some of them basically funneling everything into repurchases, some are paying down debt. Like, in your view, what would you prefer those people do?
Well, it's a great, you have great instincts, because someone very smart with oil, I don't know if I read it or they told me or whatever, but they said it's the same thing for everybody. You've got two variables here. You've got the asset, the price of oil, and everyone's dealing with the same thing, oil and gas. Now, some of the fields and reserves are different, and they have different break evens and all that, but you're dealing with the same thing, the commodity, oil and natural gas. The only other variable is the management. So my understanding is that capital allocation is like extremely consequential in this business. And if you ride with a champion, you could get a 100-bagger if you get a company that's small enough. If you ride with someone that thinks they're a champion and they're not, literally you could go to zero because it's such a debt intensive business. So that is the management and the capital allocations are a huge factor. One thing I just want to point out there with how capital intensive it is, but there's another reason why I'm attracted to Ring and PEDEVCO, and that's the kind of oil they have. Their oil and gas, it comes from what they call conventional oil and gas rock. It's rock under the ground, and it's not shale. And it seems like there's like either one or two other public companies that deal with conventional oil where it comes out of the ground. It doesn't come out of the ground as fast, but it's got a much slower decline and it lasts for much longer. Versus shale, it comes out of the ground really quick, but it's got a rapid decline. It seems like those two companies, maybe one or two other ones. And then it seems like, at least my experience, almost every single other public oil and gas company is shale. And shale is not something I've been as attracted to as conventional. So it is a very capital intensive business. It is totally up to the management. And there's been a huge cycle in the shale industry where it was all about investment and growth. And that's what they were doing with the capital. And they weren't showing cash flow or profit. They were just growing, growing, growing. And then the price of oil dropped around 2015. And investors said, wait a second, where's our cash? Where's our money? And the whole kind of mindset of the industry changed. And basically, I guess my point is management overall as a group, they'll do whatever the money wants, the money class, the investors. And back in the day, investors wanted growth, so they grew. Now investors want free cash flow, dividend yields, moderate growth. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, I like it. We'd better move on because I think all the ESG investors have well and truly skipped past this bit. So let's talk Google. Yeah. I know you're pretty involved with Google in your day job. I would hope you have some pretty nice insights into this particular business. And it sounds like it's a brand new position in 2022, as far as I know, and a pretty big one for you. So what's the deal with Google?
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with Google. I work in digital marketing. Maybe you should talk to Jack and ask him to check his emails every now and then, because all I do, Tom, is send Jack advice emails on your guys' podcast. So many marketing ideas. Nice. There's one I shared on my podcast, which I did a podcast. I came back to Tea Time the other day, and I was too rusty, so I took it down. But in that one, and I'll share it here now, I came up with the idea there needs to be a punch card conference once a year. Like, it's so hot where I am, Tom, in Oklahoma. It's so hot. 44 degrees Celsius.
Come to New Zealand. It's middle of winter.
If you do the punch card in New Zealand, I would love to go. Like, that's what I want you guys to do. I want to travel more. I want the whole gang to get together. And you guys need to put on the punch card conference. And all the listeners loved it when I shared the idea. And I told them to all ask you guys about when is the conference happening without even explaining to you what it is. But you guys could all get together, the audience could get together, we'll pay money, you guys can use that money to give us food, and you can bring in some speakers to pitch stock ideas and give us interesting business lectures. It can start small, but I thought that'd be an awesome idea. So anyway, I'm involved with marketing. Google's a big part of marketing these days. And I got into Google stock like in 2015 or 2014 or 2015, whenever they did like a stock split and renamed the company Alphabet. And the Michael Jordan of CFOs, Ruth Porat, I think she was at one of the big banks in New York City. She came over to Google around that time as a CFO and kind of changed the way the company presents itself to investors and tells its story and all that kind of stuff. And the moral of this story is I got lucky. I bought Google cheap, didn't know what I was doing back then. Google, I bought it at like $600 or something. This was pre-split. Goes up to $1,800 for reference. Forget that. It goes up to, I think, $1,200 or $1,500 or something. I sell, which was the stupidest thing I could have ever done. And then it goes up like a double or a triple from there or something like that. So I learned my lesson. And ever since then, I've been kind of biding my time waiting to get back in there. And I have an article about this, why I made Google a 25% position on my website. I've got a lot of stuff on my mind, Tom. I forget a lot of things. And it was good to go back and read this article because this was a heck of an investment. Like my reasoning, how simple I kept it was really good. And I haven't done anything with it. I've just kind of kept it there since then, since May. And I plan to basically, as I always say every time I'm recorded on the internet, never sell this investment ever. And then things happen and sometimes I sell. But it's a wonderful business. It's a compounder. I'm going to hold it. I learned my lesson and we can get into why. But that's kind of my history with Google.
Cool. Well, maybe give us the rundown. I haven't really ever done a deep dive on Google. Obviously, they've got Google Search, they've got YouTube, they've got a cloud business, which I must say I don't know a huge amount about. So how are you thinking about kind of the main aspects of the business, what the future looks like for them, and then give us kind of some of the numbers. I mean, at the end of the day, wonderful business versus price is kind of the key thing.
Yeah. So let's, and I like the way the order you lay it out there. Let's talk about the wonderful business aspect. Then let's talk about why I bought now. So wonderful business. They have search. Obviously their market share in search is huge. And when I think about search, I think about that business continuing to grow. I think about that business being dominant. And also I think about that business and I see it all the time. It's a win-win-win, Charlie Munger approved, if I may. I would say it's a, who knows what he thinks about it. But when we hear Charlie Munger and people who talk to Charlie Munger talk about win-win-win, it's one of those win-win-wins for me. Obviously, Google wins when people click on ads and send money to Google. Businesses win because unlike some other platforms, it's marketing that actually works and produces profits for those businesses. And then customers win because they get connected with really great businesses and get exactly what they're looking for, whether they click on an ad or whether they're just using the search product in general. Also, I think customers win with YouTube. Like, yes, we're happy to watch ads because the amount of entertainment and knowledge we get for free is so amazing. Think of all the creators like yourself that are winning through YouTube and all the businesses that can get exposed to their audiences through YouTube. It's just a win-win-win environment. So for various reasons, I see their advertising business continuing to get stronger and grow. YouTube is 2 billion users. It's great. There's magic about it, and it only gets better and better as more people get on here and spend time here and create here. And then their cloud business, according to my article, when I looked at it in May, is growing at 40% a year. And as my understanding of it is they're number three, and they're a growing number three. You've got Amazon, you've got Microsoft, then you've got Google, and then way past that, you've got the rest. And so they're in the top three, and they're growing. On top of all of that, You've got a lottery ticket, which is Waymo, which is their driverless robo taxi business, driverless cars. My understanding of it is that in an area of Arizona, Waymo vehicles are driving around at certain parts of the day, possibly driving customers with nobody in the vehicle. So it's like a real thing that's happening, and that's what I'm calling a lottery ticket because I'm happy to buy all of that other stuff for the price of Google, and I'm getting that for free. So could be wrong about Waymo, but they're in the mix when it comes to driverless, and I think that's going to be a huge industry. So that's the business. And you want to get into the numbers?
Yeah. Give us the valuation part and
okay. Think so, about that. So let's start with the balance sheet. Take a sip here. Not Tom, not a super investor sip, actually, didn't we? Like I told
should
you,
do,
I'm
should rusty. We do it quickly now? Let's just sneak in a super investor sip for the people
that have something to sip on?
Got to this point. Yeah, I'm good to go.
Okay, what do you have?
Just water.
Okay. Everybody, let's become super investors. Grab your favorite drink. Mine is coffee. Tonight I've got a Gatorade, and Tom has a water, just a water, as he says. I don't know what that means. Maybe he's drinking a little something later, but during punch card, I don't know if he has to do that to deal with those guys for an hour, but just the water. And let's remember the three things that Ben Graham taught us. Number one, a stock is not just a piece of paper, it's ownership in a real business. Number two, Mr. Market is there to serve us and provide us with opportunities. And number three, always invest with a margin of safety. With that said, take your super investor sip and let's become super investors together.
All right.
It works, Tom. It works. So let's start with, speaking of margin of safety and just being conservative, the balance sheet. When I wrote this article in May, so earlier this year, May 2022, $15 billion of debt. Oh my gosh, that's so much debt. $15 billion of debt, $134 billion of cash. So what are the odds I'm going to go broke on this? I don't think they exist. So very, very comfortable with the balance sheet. Now, and beyond that, I even ran some numbers. Like we have I don't know what the deal is with this recession that everyone is just penciling into their calendar. Everyone thinks we're having a recession. It's just coming up. It's just, here it comes. We may not have one, but if we have one, sometimes advertising is vulnerable during recessions. What happens if there's a recession and their earnings are flat or go down, whatever? I looked up their net cash compared to their like operating expenses, and they could run, based on my rough numbers, like 3 years, not laying anybody off, not making a dollar of revenue, which obviously would never happen, just with their net cash. So I feel very secure in the investment in terms of the downside. Now, as far as the price goes, it looks like, again, this is back in May. I think I'm like, maybe it was down today. So I was up 3% on the investment. Now I'm maybe down 2 or 3%. So these prices are probably close. But I have the market cap in May at $1.5 trillion. You back out the net cash and the enterprise value is $1.4 trillion. And last year in 2021, they earned $76 billion. And I looked at what they're expected to earn this year, and I looked at what they're expected to earn in coming years. How did I know that? Tom, I invest on the shoulders of giants like yourself, even though I haven't bought Thor yet. I'm still – let me get back to you on that. But I invest on the shoulders of giants like yourself, like Warren Buffett, Monish Pabrai, and a favorite of this show, Guy Spier, and Charlie Munger. And I also invest with Training Wheels. I'm a shameless cloner who uses Training Wheels. It's like pretty pathetic, but it works. I use Value Line, and Value Line gives you estimates on what the company is expected to earn next year and what they earned, full data on what they earned over the previous 10 years and what they're expected to earn next year. And they also go out a handful of years. And are they right every time? Probably not, but they seem to know what they're doing. And next year, 2022, Google's expected to earn $100 billion. And so I paid a price to EV of 18 times last year. Oh, excuse me. They're expected to earn the same this year and then $100 billion in 2023. So price to earnings last year, price to earnings this year, enterprise value to earnings, I paid a price of 18. Now, if you go on next year, if they do earn $100 billion as expected, my enterprise value to price was 14. And the logic of the investment here is not only do I think Google is going to continue to grow for a very, very long time, but I don't think they're going to be trading at a price of of an enterprise value to price of 14 times. I think that's ridiculous. So I think they're going to more trade for 20 to 25 times their enterprise value or their price, whatever, however you want to look at it. And so if they do earn $100 billion in 2023, next year, and they trade for 20 times that, the business will sell for $2 trillion. If they trade for 25 times that, that's $2.5 trillion. And then if you look at what I bought it for, enterprise value, that's like a 25% compounded return, 46% compounded return, if they do earn that and then sell for that in 2023. But forget every stupid thing I just said. I don't look at investing that way. I'm not trying to price Google to trade 1 year from now or 2 years from now. I bought it for an enterprise value to price of 18. If they earn what they're expected to earn next year, I bought it for an enterprise value to price of 14. I think they're going to do nothing but grow for as long as I can foresee. And I think it's ridiculous for them to sell for not only a price of 14, but a PE of 15. I don't think they'll ever sell for that. So then I looked at my downside margin of safety and I was like, okay, basically what is if they do make $100 billion, which I think they will, maybe it's not next year, maybe it's in a few years, that's a $1.5 trillion market cap. That's essentially what I bought it for. And so I don't think there's hardly any downside here at all. So how did I find this investment? Obviously I know about Google, but I'm sitting there reading the Wall Street Journal, trying to be a better person, a wiser person every day, live in balance so I can think smart and all that, think straight. Reading the Wall Street Journal, earnings come out around May. YouTube did not grow as much as Wall Street expected. The price goes down like 5%. It was already down 15% from the high last fall, as we were talking about. It's down 20% from the high. I run these numbers. And around that time, I had seen again the Warren Buffett video from the 80s where the guy comes to Omaha and he talks about the fat pitch down the middle of the plate and all that. Tom, I literally felt like I was in the batter's box and I felt and I saw the baseball just come down the middle of the plate slow, just like this. I wound up and I knocked it out of the park. 25, 30% allocation. And it's so easy from here. Like, number one, these kind of businesses, Google, Apple, they don't really, they're much more likely to trade higher just overall because they're always going to usually be doing good. So it gives me a nice little piggy bank if I need to access it for tremendous value opportunities. But I also follow the wonderful business holding checklist. And all I have to do, as long as the business is getting better and it's not egregiously overvalued, or there's not another wonderful business I want to move it into, all I have to do is hold. And if it ever gets egregiously overvalued, I'll think about selling. And if it ever stops getting better, I'll think about selling. Or if there's another wonderful business I like better, I'll think about selling. Or if there's a Ted Weschler Dillard's perfect kind of net asset value, not that that was, but like a just a perfect Morse kind of like value investment, I'll consider it. But it would have to be perfect. And in the meantime, my money compounds in it, and I sleep very, very well at night, having my money in this business. So that's the genesis of that investment. And I feel like I was basically buying it for 18 times earnings, 14, 15 times expected earnings next year. And I think it's going to do nothing but grow. So wonderful business at a good price. That's all it was. Very simple.
Love it. Well, I've got one very quick follow-up then. We're a bit short on time. We're going to have to run in a few minutes. So let's cover that and then we'll jump into maybe one or two audience questions. I put up a community post grabbing some of those. So my quick question basically is just around the cash, I guess cash and short-term investments at Alphabet. So obviously a lot of downside protection from that. You could argue perhaps a little too much downside protection, I think some people would say. Have they laid out any plan to allocate that to buybacks, dividends, acquisitions, anything like that?
Not that I know details about off the top of my head. I believe they're involved. I believe there's a buyback. I shouldn't say that. I'm pretty confident there's a buyback program going on. And I think when this earnings came out and YouTube was a little less than people expected, they said they were going to continue buying back stock. So nothing major that I know about, especially I don't think on the acquisition front, but as early as cloud is, I feel like there's probably a lot of investment going on there. And then the Waymo stuff as well, but they make so much money that even if you're investing in stuff, the cash is going to pile up And we'll see what they do with it. But I have no qualms as a shareholder. I'm have the utmost confidence, full 100% of 100% in the CEO, and the way he's running the business, and also in the CFO. She's the Michael Jordan of CFOs. So I feel great about the management as well, on top of everything.
Got it. Cool. All right. Well, let's jump into some questions. Just first off, we've covered a few of them that people are interested in. The top rated comments on the YouTube community post were all either Google or oil, or the next one down was just a comment from Jeremy saying, tell him we miss him. Looking forward to the episode. So it's good to have you on here. We have got a question. I'm a little worried that if I asked you this question, that might take up the rest of the episode, but let's do it anyway. We've got one on Carvana, probably one of your, I would say easily your most controversial stock pick when you've come on to PunchGuard and that sort of thing. So this is a question from Jonathan. Ask him about his Carvana position. Why does he own this unprofitable and unproven business model with no moat and a high chance of a total loss of capital? What do you have to say there?
So I'll just say this. There is a lot of controversy about this investment, this company, I should say, and it brings out weird things in a lot of people.
Yeah.
I don't want anything to do with that. I'm making an investment with my own money. A lot of things people don't realize is, like, this stock is down 90%. So it's not the same as looking at it when it was up 10 times from this. So with that said,
down 90%. That's sort of, you've purchased it around these prices though. You're not saying you were down 90%.
No, yeah, correct. I purchased it at like $4.5 to $5 billion market cap.
Cool.
Yeah. And basically where it trades now, but, why make the investment? It's essentially comes down to, one of those things that I think if it works, it's going to be so big. And from these prices, the multiple is going to be so big that it's worth taking the risk that it might not work. So it's a different kind of investment. There's a great write-up from Saga Partners. His name is Joe Frankenfield. And I would encourage everyone to Google that. He puts it out there on his website. That essentially is I agree with that thinking. And then you can go to YouTube and look at Cliff Sosin Carvana and get his thoughts on Carvana. Basically it's just, I think it's a business that's necessary. I think that I can't imagine a world without it. And I think it could grow tremendously. I think there's a moat involved. And then I think it can make it through as they get to that point of profitability that it takes with operational leverage. So that's kind of the highlights, just to keep it short. But those are a couple great resources for people to go look at.
Yeah, cool. And I think I said this on PunchGuard when we had you on to talk a little about Carvana. Like, one of the more interesting things about this investment to me, Carvana actually aside, really, is taking one of these investments that has a lot of upside, but it doesn't necessarily have all the downside protection anywhere near something like Google, for example. So one of the more interesting aspects was just position sizing, really. So could you speak to how you think about that with an investment like Carvana?
Yeah, so I went with a 10% position in the After Dinner Investor portfolio. That's a fixed pool of money. And I went with a 10% position personally, but that's on a obviously growing, because I'm still working and making money. And I'm not so young anymore, Tom. I'm older than you, I think. I am not young.
You got a longer runway than Warren.
That's for sure. That's for sure. But I am not young. But I have a bit of a runway here. So, but honestly, I don't think they're going broke. Like, it wasn't like, oh, if it works out, it's going to be amazing. But if it doesn't work out, oh, it's because they're going to have problems with their business. Like, in a standalone environment, and nothing crazy happens with interest rates or macro and stuff, I'm not worried about them getting through this. Like, I'm not worried. Now, if we do have problems in the macro environment, they are in an industry and they're in a vulnerable position as a business where you can lose your entire investment. And macro things really do affect it. So, like, Google's so strong and their business is so... Or take Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is so strong, we can have a recession, depression, whatever. The equity of Coca-Cola is not going to go bankrupt or get wiped out. But in the used car business, with when interest rates are involved and selling loans to investors are involved and credit markets are involved, all that kind of stuff, I would encourage everyone to listen or read the entire Guy Spier book, Education of a Value Investor. But right at the end of the book, he talks about either an investment he made in CarMax or a potential investment he was going to make in CarMax right around 2008. And he saw the way the macro affected that business. Same thing's going on with Carvana. It's extremely macro exposed, if you will, and especially the state they're in. So I'm not worried about their model or their numbers or their ability to control cost going forward. It's just, I think there's obviously a macro risk anytime you get involved with an investment like that. So for me, my number's 10%, especially based on other things I own in the portfolio. But as we know, you got to get that feeling, as we heard Guy Spier tell us on your show. And I really learned from that. And with Carvana at 10%, the water's still under my knees and I feel comfortable. So that was my number.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, I think we've pretty much run out of time, Jason, so we'll have to wrap it up there. But it's always great speaking with you. I have been listening to your podcast for,
wow,
I don't even know how long at this point. It's got to be at least 3 years at a guess. How long have you been running the podcast?
I think I started the After Dinner Investor portfolio in the fourth quarter of 2018. So we're going to 19, 20, 21, 20. We're going to come up on 4 years, I think, later this year.
Okay. Yeah. I was there before you started the portfolio, I think. So I've been listening to the podcast for a while. So it's always good. And it's been pretty cool, frankly, just to see your evolution as an investor over time as well. So I really enjoy speaking with you. I think the people listening like to hear from you as well. So thanks for coming on. Just very quickly, we actually did have a question just around kind of where you're posting content at the moment. So do you want to plug anything, any content that you are still posting and where people can follow along?
I just want to say thank you for inviting me on. Thank you for being a friend. It's been so great to meet you and the other Punch Card guys, but especially you. And I'm glad that in this weird world, we somehow connected through my podcast, your YouTube channel. It all kind of seemed to start around the same time. We're not one of these pandemic guys that started the content because we were sent home. We're the real ones. and we've been doing it since 2018. So it's been great to get to know you. And I love coming on here. And I said it on my show, you have the best investing podcast in the world. Where can people find me at After Investor on Twitter? Anything I'm doing, I keep updated there. And then generally, as far as the content goes, I have the After Dinner Investor podcast. It comes out as a podcast weekly, but I record it live on the YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and After Dinner Investor Wednesday afternoons. And so that's what I'm doing.
Perfect. Cool. I will link that all on the show notes for anyone listening on audio, and it'll be in the YouTube description if you're watching the video. So thanks again, Jason. We will we'll do this again in a few months, I think.
I'd love to. Anytime.